Today on Fearless, we are going to meet Sharon White. Now, that name might not spring out to you immediately, but Sharon has had some unbelievable positions in her career. She grew up in Leighton, the daughter of immigrants from Jamaica, and she was the first person in her family to go to university at Cambridge. And then from there, 30 years in the civil service, working at the Treasury, working with fantastic geeks in the Treasury. Lots of things we're going to learn about that. And she also went and chaired Ofcom. Challenging. It was a bridge for her from the merging of civil service with commercial, because you've got people who are in the commercial sector having to deal with Ofcom, and Ofcom represents the people as well, to chairman of John Lewis Partnership. So I can't wait to unpack with her that progression of her career and what makes her fearless. Sharon, welcome.
Hi, this is really exciting.
Oh, this is great. It's fortuitous to have you today, because I was, you know, we started this morning with the Telegraph just announcing that change at John Lewis. You've been there for 4 years. You finish next February, I think. And, you know, from Leighton to the chairman of John Lewis, with many things in between, there's a lot to unpack.
Yeah, and I have to say, I'm a bit of a fangirl here too, so I'm looking forward to this as a great conversation.
Me too, and I think it should be a conversation, but and I don't want to be chronological, but sometimes it helps us to just kind of place of when you are at school in Leighton, what was your ambition age 16? What did you think was the most that you would get out of your life?
So I was a rather peculiar 16-year-old. My parents came from Jamaica, kind of Windrush generation. And I was a very nerdy, quite sporty, quite introverted, quite serious teenager. And actually, if you'd asked me at 16 what I wanted to do, it would be a combination of, I used to run a lot, so I used to love athletics. Probably somewhere between I'd love to run in the Olympics and I wasn't quite fast enough, or I wanted to go off. It was kind of time of Live Aid, so I wanted to go off to kind of sub-Saharan Africa and kind of
save the world.
Yeah. And actually at 16, I'd done quite well in my sort of exams, and I was just thinking about what I do next. I was never one of those kids that was brilliant at one thing. I was always kind of pretty good at lots of things.
So harder with that to think that's my career.
Yeah.
You know, if you were incredible and the top person at running of anyone in the whole county, easier choice to make that I can be Tessa than I'm good at this.
Yeah, and I was never, I mean, I know it sounds really peculiar, but I was never, even now I think, what on earth am I going to do when I grow up?
But this is a heart of something, which is why, how can you be an ageless woman? It's to say, at the age we both are in this, I'm in one decade ahead of you, but what are we going to be when we grow up is still the question on our minds.
Yeah, and that also feels exciting. So as a 16-year-old, the most important thing that happened to me was I just done my equivalent of GCSEs, and there was this like very cool A-level economics teacher who I'd never met, never taught me, called Jerry O'Connell, who used to look a bit like Mike Reed of the old, some of you may remember, as a DJ for Radio 1. Dark blue suit, white shirt, white tie, knotty tie, super, super smart, Leighton, East London, all girls school. I just thought he was very cool.
Yeah.
And he said, "Had you thought about economics?" And it was because of him I then studied. It was because of him I then went to Cambridge.
The story, I think, that anyone who maybe even starts off in a further education far away from where most of their class are going, that there's going to be a teacher there who got them there. There's never not a teacher there.
Yeah, always a teacher. And he had grown up in Walthamstow, so very close to where I grew up, had himself gone to Cambridge, and then he came back to East London.
Yeah.
So kind of just, I found it just, he was interesting story.
How did you find Cambridge?
Kind of, how long have you gone?
I mean, it's just like, it's, you know, for friends of mine who go, who might have gone from a privileged white background, they found there was more of a challenge at Cambridge than Oxford. So I'm interested from a girl from Leighton.
Yeah, it's a funny story for me, because on the one hand, really bizarrely, there was a part of me that had always wanted to go, even from a small child. I used to watch the boat race, and because...
You want to go to Oxbridge or one of them?
Cambridge.
You always Cambridge. Interesting.
Because Cambridge was closer to East London.
Yes,
so
that's
we
true.
always supported the light blues. Slightly kind of interesting. And Cambridge, it's classic, best of times, worst of times. Mm-hmm. So I was there 85 to 88. Most colleges had only just...
Become mixed.
More female entrance. Of 300 people studying economics, maybe 20, 25 of us were women. I think there were two black people in my year across the university doing economics, myself and a friend who was at Queen's. And so in a way, the fact that it's all so out of your kind of comfort zone, but at the same time, it was thrilling. And I met people and I did things that I wouldn't have done in any other circumstance. And I think it also, it's that thing where basically all the women just kind of pulled together. Mm-hmm. We didn't quite notice. And then you suddenly realize all the women are sitting on the front row together, or you're forming a study group together. And some of my best friends are from Cambridge. My husband was in the year below me doing economics. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it was in so many ways completely alien to how I grew up.
Mm. What was the most alien?
Maybe it was the confidence. Maybe it was the sense of... For the first time, it felt very explicit that I wasn't expected to be there. So when I grew up in East London, it was pretty multicultural, mm-hmm. and was becoming increasingly multicultural. And I went to all-girls schools. And I couldn't tell you when I went to Cambridge how many times I was asked the question, so where are you from? And I used to say, well, I'm from East London and it's kind of 50 miles down the M11. But Sharon, where are you really from? Mm-hmm. And is it East London in South Africa? So there's a sense in which you could be black and not British. Mm-hmm. You could be black and Nigerian. You could be black and South African. But the idea that I was a British-born, state-educated girl who grew up not a million miles away geographically from the university, it was never sort of criticism. It was just outside most... of my friends, most of my fellow students' experience, because they didn't go to school with people like me.
So what's interesting, at the time you're like, well, let me explain it to you. I'm actually from Leighton. And so it's an education piece, but it's not, I feel insulted. It's just like there's such a lack of education here. Now, then we have wind the movie forward to Buckingham Palace, to the incident last year. And exactly the same question is asked of somebody by the Queen's lady-in-waiting. But do you feel if somebody asks you that now, you're going to be much tougher with them? Or do you see what I mean? I want to know how you feel about that, because everyone is an individual different sense of how they deal with that question.
Yeah, I think having lived with it, so I always assume good intent. Mm-hmm. I also think there's a generational thing because, I mean, I grew up in the 70s and 80s and I knew that my parents hadn't grown up in this country. And I think it might be different again for my children who mm-hmm. would never cross their mind that they're anything other than British, would never cross their mind about their heritage but being outside the UK. And so, I mean, I'm pretty phlegmatic mm-hmm. and I assume good intent. It's just when I'm asked the question, there's just part of you that feels, gosh, I'm not sure I belong. Maybe I thought I belonged.
Do you still feel that today?
I think it's different today because I've been, you know, as you said, for my slightly mad sort of random career, I've been uber lucky. I've worked with, I've worked domestically, I've worked internationally, I've worked with lots and lots of different people and loved mm-hmm. it. And I think I've just got more confidence than I had as an 18, 19 year old for the first time of stepping out of home.
It is that thing of being a woman with confidence as opposed to the colour of your skin in this instance, because I think there's some meetings I'll be in. Like this morning, I was saying, I was at Meta and we were in a very small setting of AI. And there was part of me thinking, am I qualified in this room, in this setting to ask a question?
That's so interesting.
You know, it was purely on my level of how much I believe I'm entitled to be in this room in a very specific area of people who are quite educated around the subject we're discussing. It's not imposter syndrome, because I don't love the word imposter syndrome. I don't know how you feel about that word, but it is that what that makes me then do, and I think it's relevant for people who are on that career path, is what can I go and learn that makes me feel more qualified to be in that room, as opposed to putting this label of imposter syndrome. Imposter syndrome to me is a lack of knowledge.
So I think this is quite complicated. So I remember as I say, I mean, a bit like you, I don't sort of, the term imposter syndrome doesn't hang well with me. But I definitely remember the times when you walk into a room, and I remember a few times when I was still in government, when you're chairing the mm-hmm. meeting.
You're running it.
You're running the meeting. It doesn't have your name, but it has...
your position.
Has chair of X. And I walk into the room, and obviously the chair's label is in the middle of the boardroom or the meeting room table. And you sit down and you pour yourself some water. And if it's people I don't know, you can always just sort of feel that sort of slight shuffle, or which is, it's not quite expected. But mm-hmm. I've got to a stage in my life that it's something that I definitely lean more into than feeling a lack of confidence, because actually you might have been expecting somebody like me to be leading, chairing the discussion, but actually we're going to have a great conversation. You're going to, I don't know, it's something about myth busting or creating new stories or creating new pictures, but I've never felt that it's held me back.
Yeah.
And I think the Cambridge experience, even in that sort of very strange way of having real senses of whether I fully belonged or not, it was the most amazing sort of translator and confidence builder, because I don't think I've ever been quite as scared again.
Yeah, it's like in at the deep end.
Yeah, really, like in at the deep end. Yeah. Completely.
For people listening, let's say your rite of passage is Cambridge. Mm-hmm. You go straight to civil service, which is very much a path of stay there long enough and you always get promoted. Kind of, from an outside in, I'm just going to say that, right? As opposed to entrepreneurial or aggressive commercial business. So you had this entry into a sector where there's a progression, there's a grading of your salary. It's all very graded by how many years have you been here? What, you know what I mean? That's how I see the civil service. I don't know if it still is.
It's a kind of really interesting sort of outside perspective. So interesting, straight after Cambridge, I actually spent a year in Birmingham working for a church in the local community that had been subject to racial disturbances. Mm-hmm. So I actually spent a year figuring out what I was going to do with the rest of my life, running youth groups and teaching English to Bangladeshi communities. And then I joined the civil service, not because I thought, oh my God, I'm going to spend the next however long I spent, 30 years or something, but because I was never particularly drawn by, at those times, the private sector roles that lots of my friends became accountants and management consultants who'd done economics with me, or, you know, got into sort of classic city jobs. And I was always interested in, I don't mean this in a kind of really altruistic way, but how do you kind of make things better?
How do you make change?
How do you make change? Mm-hmm. And I had a friend who joined the civil service, and I thought, well, this is great. So you're in a kind of situation where hopefully you can make a bit of a difference. I'm using my economics. I'm really interested in kind of social policy. So how does the health service get better? Why are some parts of the country doing well and other parts not doing well? And I thought I would do 18 months and, you know, sort of move into the next thing. And I stayed through my 20s and my 30s and half of my 40s. And on the outside, it may feel like kind of job's worth it. You know, if you spend long enough, you know, you'll get...
I mean, you spent enough time to get a pension from them, didn't you?
I spent enough time to get a pension. But also, I was mostly at the Treasury during that time, even though I hopped at departments a little bit, which is a very unusual part of the civil service. It's quite... I always describe it as being quite anarchic.
During whose tenure were you at the Treasury?
Oh, so I've done...
Gordon Brown?
Oh, I've done everybody. So, I mean, when I first joined the Treasury, Margaret Thatcher was still Prime Minister.
Yes.
So I've lived through Norman Lamont as Chancellor. I've lived through Ken Clark, who was fantastic. I mean, when Gordon Brown was Chancellor, I was working for Tony Blair at number 10. So this, I mean, I've had a long life.
Yeah.
And the thing about the Treasury, it's basically run by the 22, 23, 24, 25-year-olds.
The Treasury
is. It's a very anarchic...
This scares us, by the way, when you say this.
Brilliant people, but it's a very unhierarchical... For people who think about the civil service as being a very bureaucratic, very, very smart, very agile, very flexible, quite anarchic culture.
Going back to what we are as a podcast, Fearless... It sounds already to me, when you're at Cambridge and those first few early years, that you learnt fearlessness because you just, you maybe didn't have a deep-rooted thinking, I don't have permission. It's like you didn't have that, I have no filter, all right? So that stops me from, I mean, that makes it easier for me to say what I think. But I sort of feel that you have always said what you think.
I've never sort of lacked. So I think confidence is such a sort of interesting and difficult word in relation to women.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm somebody who's sort of naturally quite sort of introverted and quite sort of thoughtful and quite self-aware. I've never been afraid to have my sort of viewpoint in...
In something you're a part of.
In something I'm part of. And whether that's even before going to college, that's just the sort of peculiarity of, as I say, growing up in a country that your parents don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
So if my mother wanted to contact the council, you know, my brother or I
would do it for her.
We'd write a letter if she's, I don't know whether my mother really even knew what exams I was studying at school because she left school at 11.
Mm-hmm.
My dad left school when he was 15. And so I think there's something about, because my experience growing up was so unusual, it's almost as though if everything's so different, you're not sort of highlighting the 5% or the 10%. It's, well, I'm at Cambridge today, but actually 2 years ago I was at school and my mother was so very different, was the only, when I grew up, was particularly when I first started at school as a primary school, my mother was almost the only person who worked.
Yeah.
You know, because my friends all went home at lunchtime because their mothers were home.
Mm.
I'm so used to not quite fitting in, I think, is really what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And that being something I'm sort of almost comfortable and confident in, if that makes sense.
It makes sense because I think if I look at people who are successful, they didn't have this, not they didn't have this fear, but it didn't stop them from being inquisitive, asking, just challenging, just feeling their right to be heard.
Yes.
You know, that's what it is. It's you feel you have a right to be heard.
Yes. Or if you put it more, I don't see that my voice is any...
Different from anyone else's.
Different from anybody else's.
Mm. So how can one bottle up this and sell it? Because I think lots of people want it. Lots of people want to feel they can have that. What's the advice you can give to people listening when they're thinking, how do I really have this faith in myself to an extent where I can demand what I feel need to be the changes, have the confidence to make the statements at meetings and be heard?
Yeah, I think definitely something, I mean, we talked a bit about sort of my childhood, but definitely the thing that's helped me as I've got older and my career has sort of progressed is I love talking to people and I love finding out their stories and I think really getting under the skin of their stories. And the more I've spoken to people that I massively admire and are massively successful, and you always reach a point that there's something that's happened to them, which always means that that sort of extraordinary kind of, not veneer, but that extraordinary confidence and success, there's always something.
Yeah.
And so I'm a great collector of stories, not because it means I think about them any less or I value them any less, but it's realizing, gosh, you've been through something too.
Mm-hmm.
And actually when you were extraordinary in that meeting or you made that amazing commercial decision, you know, you didn't sleep for 3 nights beforehand or 4 nights afterwards. And I think, I mean, we've all, both of us have had sort of ups and downs in life. And I think realizing that there isn't somehow a sort of completely different population of people who just get it and are brilliant and are always feeling completely confident, but we all go through our phases, has massively helped me, particularly conversations I've had with since I joined the partnership, which has been quite a rollercoaster ride the last few years. And particularly talking to other CEOs and chairs, I find that really a great source of comfort. So I guess my advice would be the person that you think is amazing and scarily so, take them out for coffee and lunch and just get under the skin that they've got the same demons and
yeah, it's when you know that it's what you know. It's that old age adage of don't compare how you feel inside with the exterior of somebody else because you'll only ever come out,
yeah,
you know, less than. And it's understanding how you're perceived might be a lot better than that little voice inside your head, which is not you, which is not you.
The other thing I would say, I'm a very grateful person.
And yeah, that's interesting. And where does gratitude play a part then in being fearless?
So I think the fact that, so you talked about, you know, the meeting that you rock up and think, oh my gosh, you know, should I have a right to be here? There's something about being grateful that you're yeah, in the room.
Yeah, that's so true. And I did feel that. I felt such gratitude when I left it.
And maybe because you've got these amazing people. Or for me, my benchmark is always, oh my goodness, my mum left school at 11. Okay. And I'm worried about, you know, what I say and how I'm in the room.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pinching myself. I'm so grateful. So I live a lot by gratitude is a big thing for me.
Yeah. Going from being very policymaking to commercial.
Yes.
That really, I'm not going to say that was Ofcom. I'm going to say that was John Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
So what's, for you, what was the biggest mind shift you had to make for that transition?
Yeah. So I say a couple of things. First of all, that Ofcom was a step.
Yeah.
Because as you say, I'd been a sort of behind the scenes policy person, obviously kind of big financials because you're dealing with the country's balance sheet.
To front of house. At Ofcom, especially during a very tumultuous time.
Yeah. And obviously you're then essentially dealing with consumer interests with some very, very important companies and some, you know, extraordinary chief executives. So everything from BT to Sky to ITV, the BBC. So that for me, whatever it looks like from the outside, was very much a sort of transition, mm-hmm, because you're in the middle of a P&L, a profit and loss account for an enormous company where your decisions, your regulatory decisions, the decisions for the consumer interest, mm-hmm, also, and also affects their bottom line and whether they invest, etc. And then the step to the partnership. So the thing I always emphasise with the partnership is that we're a great commercial business and we're also unique as a business because we are owned by the 76,000 people, partners we call ourselves, who work there. And interestingly, historically, lots of civil servants, lots of people from the armed forces.
Yeah, lots of people from the armed forces.
Joined the partnership because of the ethos. My predecessor had been in the army. My mm-hmm predecessor's predecessor had been a civil servant.
But also it was that transition.
The border trade.
It's post-war. 53 or 57?
Yeah.
When did it start?
53.
53. So this is 7 years after the end of the war. A lot of people having to rejig their career, and that foundation of we all own it was, mm-hmm, it was such a unique concept. And I think that, you know, when we think of John Lewis, we think of never knowingly undersold, mm-hmm, is that tagline, which I don't know how much that mm-hmm prevails today with Amazon. And also this, we are a partnership of people. But I know that in your tenure, you came up with something that was incredibly challenging, mm-hmm, which was saying, should we get an outside investor?
Yeah.
Which was, you know, you were obviously looking at it from the economic matrix of the balance sheet and thinking, we need some cash. Let's sell something off or let's do something. But that must have been a huge challenge. And do you still believe it today? And let's just unpack that a bit.
Yeah, so if you think when I was appointed in the middle of 2019, I started in early 2020. And the partnership is, I will always hold in, it's more than affection, kind of deepest love. 5 weeks and then COVID hit.
Yeah.
So it's essentially we've had 2 years of COVID and 2 years of
non-COVID.
Long COVID and the cost of living crunch. And the issue, so the partnership, we don't have external shareholders. One of the great sort of joys and strengths of the business is it's our business. And that means we need to, you know, it's about financial independence and, you know, essentially we invest what we generate. We're also now an enormous business, £12 billion sales, 21 million customers. And so the debate we had is what's coming out through COVID, what's the best way for us to fund ourselves? Mm-hmm. And obviously one of the end of the spectrum, the best way is actually, we sell an amazing product at great prices and, you know, the cash that we generate right the way through to, we've had joint ventures in the past, or we've had examples, Ocado and Waitrose were a great partner for many years, set up as a private company with essentially with private equity, private investment in order to deliver a new service, which was, you know, food to your doorstep. And we had a conversation about, you know, would there ever be a case to have a partner, an investor who sat alongside the partnership, helped to sort of fund the plan and helped to sort of fund the growth and all the great things we wanted to do for our customers. And in the end, we've decided, you know what, it's so important for us to be super financially independent.
More important than getting outside investors.
Yeah.
So even though balance sheet will look tougher for longer, the principle's
really important.
Stay.
And actually, I mean, hats off to the team. What we've done in the last year is to work really hard and to take some really difficult decisions to generate more cash. Mm-hmm. So actually this coming year, we will be, it's our record year of investment going back into the business.
Yeah.
Both brands have generated more, twice as much cash as the previous year, because we're having to take, some difficult decisions for any business in terms of becoming more efficient.
How tough is it for you? And there are many CEOs who took over during COVID, or chairman, in any business where your back is up against it. Yeah. You come into something where you are actually laying off. Mm-hmm. You know, your primary thing is, I have to lay off, I have to do this. You're not coming into a business where people are saying, hi, welcome. that's a tough for one's resilience. Mm. So I just want to ask you personally, as the woman Sharon White, how you dealt with that?
The toughest thing always, when I think about the last 4+ years, has always been when you get to the point of, as you say, having to let partners go. Some partners who've contributed to the business for 20, 30 years, been part of management teams where everybody's incredibly connected, or you're closing a store, shuttering a store during COVID, which you can't make financially work, but has been so important to the community. And I think it's the thing that really, it does weigh on your mind. And I always think, particularly in a partnership where your partners are always also your shareholders.
Yeah.
And where the business is seen not just as a retailer, but as a national institution, in the way in which almost the BBC NHS. Yeah. So no, I mean, I'm lucky because I've got a very happy home life, and I've got...
But there must have been times when you were going home, Sharon.
Yeah, it's hard.
Just more emotionally, take your hat off for a second. Yes. As chairman, I must be really aware of what I say.
Yeah.
Because I have responsibility as chairman. I just want to understand more this sense of, it's you in this role ultimately as chairman, because chairman kind of works with CEO, but you have the final say on the board. How that feels.
I mean, I'll give you a current example, which is we've got a proposal at the moment to close our Enfield distribution site that does Waitrose deliveries, that delivers to my 88-year-old father and delivers to my home.
Mm-hmm.
Really the only person my dad sees regularly outside myself and one of his grandchildren, my son, is the person from Waitrose who comes every week and spends a bit more time with him.
Mm.
Every time I see a Waitrose van locally, it's like a pit in my stomach.
So when that closes, what will happen?
We will hope as far as possible that partners will be able to get jobs elsewhere in the business, but it's possible, it's a proposal at the moment, but it's possible they may not all get that. And it's interesting, more than any other decision of the last 4.5 years, I was there on the week we opened, I was there on the day two, I met... this is an amazing partner. I was at the site about 18 months ago called Rob, who got turned down for a job at Sainsbury's because he's deaf.
Mm.
And he joined our site because, the partnership being the partnership, we were able to pull all sorts of support together. So he's driving as a deaf person and has loved being in the partnership.
Mm-hmm.
And when the decision came to the board, you know, I thought about Rob and I thought about my dad. And it is, you feel a sense that you're letting people down, and it's really, really difficult. I was there on Friday, and you know, I came out and cried on the train back home.
From here, with your taste of commercial, what do you think in what you might next be looking at you won't want to do again? Because I think what happens in our 50s is we know what we don't want. You know, we can refine. We've got to this, I think over each decade we have this period of refinement, you know, and I think that's what the 50s is about. We don't worry what people think. I think could be the 50s, the 60s, yeah. Could be. We know what we don't want, because actually I think when I've said this before that I've said it that way, that I don't worry what people think. But you're in your 50s still. But just looking at what next there is for you.
The stage my kids are at is a massive...
How old are your kids now?
Fact is, my bigger boy is 19 and has started university, which I can't quite believe. And my younger son probably goes to college next year. I think the most important word for me at the moment is flexibility. So I'm keen to have more flexibility in my life and variety, and maybe that's that. If your question is what do you not want to repeat, I think put more positively, I'd love to be in a place where I can combine two or three things. I'd love to still have a foot in the commercial world with, you know. Big thing for me is the values of the company, what they're trying to achieve, and the kind of public interest. And also a foot in, I love the UK, it's my home, and I also want to be part of, in some small way, being part of helping, you know, make the country fairer, more productive, all those things. And maybe it's some, I don't know, some judicious combination of public and private, but I want more flexibility in my life.
So I'm going to do quick fire now.
Ooh.
A little. I want you to give me five things to think about to a woman embarking on a career. Things to remember in the back of her mind.
Friendships. Mm-hmm. When you have those really tough days, and unbelievably difficult in a workplace to have that super open conversation. Who are you going to talk to? How are you going to look after your body? I'm a big yoga, Pilates. I run. I don't run very fast anymore, but I kind of run it out. Number three, you are more visible. Love it or not love it, and don't go into it naively, but be prepared for it.
In the visibility of being a woman in the workforce, yeah.
And number four, linked to the visibility, gives you a different platform. So
explain that.
So people will ask for your views. They'll want to know what it's like being a woman in business, and actually use it as an opportunity to make it easy for the women who are following. And I guess number five, I think I'm a big one for responsibility. It sounds like quite an old-fashioned word. But I feel I've got a responsibility to ensure that in 5, 10, 15, 20 years, it is completely normalised for people like us to be doing the jobs that we're doing.
Responsibility. Would you add in, if I let you have a say, but how high up on the list is it for you around, because I think this is different. I love supporting women and I champion that, but I've never been in big business.
Yeah.
And a lot of women, like Bazoma St. John, when I did the interview with her, there was an element of her interview where there was some part of her that was like, watch my back, and not just from men. And just that, how do we change the narrative of women actually in the workforce being more supportive of other women?
Yeah. I probably had more of this in my early days when some of the women I worked alongside it had been such a difficult battle, even harder than for maybe you or I, but such a difficult battle.
For them.
For them. Mm-hmm. That there was almost a sort of, you know, raising of the drawbridge.
So therefore they couldn't have the, there was nothing left in them to be generous to other women.
Or there's only room for one woman at the board table or at the meeting table, and they've occupied it. And I think,
okay,
I think it's not advice. I just think that
however hard fought a battle is won, you must be generous.
You've got to be generous, and I think you've got to understand that progress isn't linear, and that progress comes because there are generous women and women who take the evenings that they don't really have, and they take the coffee mornings and time they don't really have to mentor and to have that conversation with the 20, 22-year-old who is thinking about giving up and can't see a way through the door. I just think it should be part of everybody's, every woman's job description. And for me in my life, I mean, some of the people who've been most generous to me actually have been men in senior positions who've been married to professional women.
Really? That's an interesting criteria.
And generally with children.
Yeah.
So they're part of the juggle, and they're part of the spinning plates, and they're part of the plates that fall. You know, people who've created part-time jobs for me because they have been the, you know, men who've been a primary child carer. Mm-hmm. I just think there's no excuse not to be generous.
Yeah, so agree with it. I think how much more can we do things champion it? I think there is a message too out there to other women who, you know, when you say that expression, they pull up the drawbridge because of how tough it's been for them. It's, yeah. I know also women who've been like that, and I just like, it's so much harder to be meaner than to be generous.
But if you've had bad experiences in
you
your
do,
life.
You do.
It's not a meanness, it's a reluctance and a hesitation because you're so worried that your gains will be lost. And I just think I've gained so much from the younger women that I speak to, that I spend time with, because they really are fearless. Mm-hmm.
Well, I loved our chat, and I hope that people at home have felt inspired by your words of wisdom, but I'm very excited to see the next stage of your journey, Sharon White.
Thank you. It's been fantastic.
I think, on reflection, the chat with Sharon was a different direction for us to go in, those of you who listen to Fearless regularly, because it was about a woman's journey with her career. And I think Sharon's had an incredible career to date, and I think there's a lot more to come. But, you know, coming from Leighton, ending up at Cambridge, ending up 30 years in civil service. I don't know about you, but I've always seen the civil service as this very grey thing, and I apologise profusely to all people who work in the civil service, but she woke me up to looking at the civil service in a different way. She woke me up to looking at the Treasury and thinking, that sounds quite an exciting place to work. Those people who are graduating from Cambridge who are being offered things. It was just an insight into how, if you, and I think this is my biggest takeaway, is if you feel that you are different in terms of how Sharon presented it in her mother, who came to the UK as a immigrant, and, you know, she was the first born in Britain member of her family, and how, I'm not saying she never felt, it's like she knew she was always different and therefore just went for it. There's something interesting in that. I haven't phrased it correctly, but I think you know what I mean by how she described it way better. And I found that fantastic. And for those people who are listening who think I'd like some tips, I asked her at the end because I just felt, you're fearless. You've been fearless all the time. Where can I find the chink in the armor where you had huge fear and you did it anyway? I just felt that she just thought, let's just do it. And that's what I found interesting, is there wasn't her saying, I'm really scared, but I did this anyway. It was like, I just, I do it. I get on with it. I felt that. Really enjoy getting to know her. I've got this other little project brewing, and I'm going to ask her to be a part of it. because I think she would contribute hugely to anything that she joins. So I hope that you enjoyed listening to this slightly different look at somebody's career journey more than their personal story. And I look forward to catching up with you again soon. Thanks for listening.